Hey, welcome to Faith Bridge. My name is Michael. I'm the director of discipleship here. And whether you are here in our live service or you're watching from our communion service or you're coming to us online, we're really glad that you're here with us this morning. I grew up running. I started training for half marathons in high school, marathons in college, and then ultra marathons in seminary. And I remember training for my first ultra marathon. It was going to be a 33-mile race in South Carolina, and I was killing it. Every single speed marker that I needed to hit, I was hitting it. I was hitting all of my distance goals. Everything was going great. There was a little bit of soreness in one of my knees, but that's normal whenever you're doing as much running as I was doing. But one day I was in the middle of one of my long runs, and in the middle of the run, it felt like someone took a hot fork and stuck it in the side of my knee. Now, you may not be a runner, but that's not normal. So I went home and then I went to bed hoping that I would just wake up and it feel better. That never really works. And so I woke up the next morning and I realized I needed to go to a physical therapist. Went to him. He did a bunch of tests on me, did an x-ray, twisted my knee in a bunch of weird ways that made me scream, analyzed my form. And at the end of all of that, he came to me and he said, "I don't think you know how to run." Now, I was used to hearing of that kind of thing from, like, baseball coaches. I was not an athletic kid, which is why I got into running in the first place. I could move my legs back and forth kind of fast without tripping too many times. And so I said, "No, I think I do know how to run." And he said, "No, I don't think you do." And he pulled out a tape of me running. And he said, "You've got a couple of habits that you don't even know that you have that are keeping you from being a healthy runner." And he pointed them out to me, that I land too hard whenever I am running and I land at the back of my foot instead of the front of my foot. And he told me that over time, those two habits were compounding into something that injured my knee. And that in order to be a healthy runner, I was going to have to get to a point where I could break both of those habits. Now, I bring that up because today we are continuing in our series called Healthy Church, but we're starting in 1 Corinthians 1. We started last week and we kind of jumped into the middle of the book in 1 Corinthians 12. Today we're going all the way back to 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul is going to have much the same conversation with the Corinthians as my physical therapist had with me. There's a pain point in the Corinthian church. Something's going wrong. But rather than address the pain point itself in this first chapter, Paul's going to tell them that they have two habits that they don't even know that they have that are keeping them from being spiritually healthy. Now, what qualifies Paul to have this conversation with the Corinthians? Well, he started the church, so he kind of gets to do that. This is what Paul did. He would travel around the world starting new churches. But if you've read the book of Acts, you know that this wasn't always Paul's life. Paul started his professional career as a Jewish scholar, and he hated Christians. He persecuted the church. He presided over the death of at least one Christian, probably more. But then he had a dramatic experience with Jesus. And after he had that experience, he left everything behind, and he began traveling the world starting new churches. And sometimes when he started a church, it went great. You read the letter to the Philippians, and you hear about a church that is loving each other well, that is loving the world well, that is sacrificing well. Paul's love leaps off the pages of that letter. 1 Corinthians ain't that kind of letter, because Corinth ain't that kind of church. Now, not from the outside. If you're on the outside looking in, you might be impressed with what you're seeing in the Corinthian church, because you'd be impressed with what you were seeing around you in the city. I put a map of ancient Corinth here on the screen. You can see that Corinth was situated right between Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and the Mediterranean, where Italy and Rome were. And you can see that it's also situated right between two harbors, which meant that ships came from all over the world, and they would dock in Corinth carrying two things: goods and ideas. And this made Corinth both an economic hub in the Roman Empire and an intellectual hub, that people came from all around the world to trade goods, and people came from all around the world to trade ideas. And the church at Corinth looked a lot like the surrounding culture. It was more diverse than many of Paul's other churches. It was more intellectually rigorous and interested than any of Paul's other churches. It was a wealthier church than many of Paul's other churches. And so Paul looks at that and he pushes that to the side and he says, that's all great. But you've got a pain point that's coming up over and over again, and it's conflict. It's conflict, which shouldn't surprise us. Because what happens when you get a bunch of people from all sorts of different walks of life coming to the same place and trying to run after the same goal? You get conflict. Just think about college football. Think about Aggies. What happens when an Aggie sees another Aggie? It's like instant friendship, instant camaraderie. I remember going to Disney World when I was a kid, and my dad saw someone else wearing an Aggie ring in line. And they started talking, and it was like they had known each other forever. And, you know, the conversation then turned to football, and because they're Aggie fans, that got a little depressing. It was like, all right, Dad, let's just get on the teacups. Let's leave this behind. But what happens? Camaraderie, friendship, there's a lot in common. Now, what happens if around Thanksgiving weekend, there's a lot of Aggies and Longhorns in the same house? You're gonna get conflict. I even just heard some hissing, right? There's gonna be hissing. There's gonna be trash talk. There's gonna be carping. And in the back of each other's minds, the Aggie and the Longhorn are both going to be proving to themselves that their school is superior and better than the other person's. The Longhorn is going to look at the Aggie and is going to say, you have to pretend to like College Station. And the Aggie is going to look at the Longhorn and is going to think, and you really think you look good in burnt orange. You don't, babe. It washes you out, right? There's conflict. They come against one another. This is what is happening in Corinth. You have a bunch of people who are fighting with each other over all sorts of things. Some small, in 1 Corinthians 1, Paul talks about like the different preachers that people in Corinth are fighting over and which one is the best and which one they like. All the way to the most important things, like whether Jesus actually rose from the dead. But rather than addressing the conflict itself in 1 Corinthians 1, Paul is going to point to the church and he's going to say that you have two habits that you don't even know that you have that are leading to this conflict and that are keeping you from becoming healthy. And so as we read this part of 1 Corinthians 1, I want us to keep that in mind too. Because there are any number of things that might be keeping us from being healthy Christians, healthy in our spiritual walk, that we've wanted to break before, that we've wondered why we can't break. I wonder if it's possible whether the two habits that Paul is going to describe for us here might also apply to us, and whether we need to break those habits too. So Paul's gonna jump in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18. The first habit that he's going to address is this: assuming that life is all about going up and to the right. Look at verse 18 with me. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. So Paul is going to set up a contrast between an up and to the right kind of life. And in order to do that, he starts with the cross, which to the rest of the world might seem about as far from an up and to the right kind of thing as you could possibly get. And that might surprise us because we love crosses. They're nice and symmetrical. It's a powerful symbol. You wear it on jewelry. You get it tattooed on your leg. You have it hanging in your house. We love crosses. But if you teleported someone from first century Corinth into this room today and they looked behind me at this glowing cross on the stage, they would think that we are out of our minds. Because to the ancient world, the cross represented only three things: torture, humiliation, and death. It was a method of execution, really a method of state-sponsored terrorism reserved for the lowest of the low. And so the rest of the world looks at Paul holding up the cross as a symbol of power and says that he's crazy. And says that the Christians are crazy for doing that. It would be like if you're walking around and you saw someone with a tattoo of a Hiroshima mushroom cloud. Or if you saw someone wearing a necklace of an electric chair. Like at best, you would think that that person is kind of weird. At worst, you're going to think that that person is backwards, ignorant, stupid, foolish, offensive, maybe even a threat. This is how the rest of the world viewed Christians. We know this because of things like anti-Christian graffiti from really early on. This is a picture of the earliest anti-Christian graffiti that we have. Some scholars say that it is the earliest depiction of Jesus that we have. It comes from anywhere between 60 years to 160 years after Jesus died on the cross. And it depicts someone worshiping a donkey dying on a cross. And the inscription on the bottom reads, "Alexandrimenos worships his God." And it's a form of graffiti mocking Christians for worshiping a God who would die on a cross. That's not up and to the right. That's down and to the left. Much better to set our sights on things that are up and to the right. That's what the rest of the culture is saying. And this is what Paul addresses in verse 19. He says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not come to know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe." So in contrast to the cross, which is down and to the left, Paul mentions these three groups that are up and to the right: the wise man, the scribe, the debater of this age. These are people that you would look at them and you would say, no matter where it is that they started, they've made it. Their life has been up and to the right. We might hear Paul talking about the lawyer, the doctor, the CEO. No matter where it is that they started, no matter where it is they began, they've made it in life. Their life has looked up and to the right. And in first century Corinth, this is what it was all about. This was deeply ingrained in their culture. Corinth, in contrast to a lot of other Roman cities, was actually a place where you could go and kind of build a good life for yourself and become wealthy. And so the idea of climbing the ladder, of being successful, that's what everybody is about. And that same thing is deeply ingrained in our culture too. We even have a term for it. It's called the American dream. That if you just work hard enough, you set your mind to it, you can be more successful and build a more successful life than your parents and your grandparents before you. And the idea of the American dream is still very much alive, isn't it? You just turn on the TV and every single commercial is trying to convince you of the same thing. That if you buy their product or use their service, you will have the kind of wealthier, healthier, better, stronger, longer life that you've always wanted to have. It extends even to things like drug commercials. Like, have you noticed that people are dancing all the time in drug commercials? Why? Like, why is it not just a guy looking at the screen saying, if you take our medicine, you will feel better? Like, why are people dancing? Well, it's because these companies want you to think that if you take the medicine, not only will you feel better, but you will have the better, wealthier, healthier, stronger, longer life that you've always dreamed of having. It extends in our culture even to things like longevity and aging. This is a picture of Brian Johnson. Brian Johnson started and sold a bunch of companies. He became a billionaire, and he most recently started a company called Don't Die, which is about making cookies, actually. No, it's not. It's about not dying. It's about avoiding death. And he does all sorts of things to keep himself from dying. He sees three doctors a week. The doctors analyze about 200 different tests that they run on his body every single week. AI's involved in tracking the way that the different tests interact with each other. He spends hours in barometric pressure chambers every single week. He wakes up at the same time every morning. He goes to bed at the same time every night. He eats the same exact thing every day. And he also injects himself with his 23-year-old son's blood every week. We might look at that and say, hey, that's a little strange. But what Paul is saying is that in a culture that is so devoted to optimization, to climbing the ladder, that it can produce someone like Brian Johnson, in that kind of culture, it's very hard not to ingest the habit or the idea, the assumption that what God really wants for you and me is to live a life that looks up and to the right. But what God wants for you and I, first off, is not a life that looks up and to the right. What God wants for us, Paul is saying, is to have a life that looks like the cross, that follows the cross, that obeys the way of the cross, even to the point that we do things that may look foolish to the rest of the world. I remember having to wrestle with this when I was in seminary. I went to seminary at Duke in North Carolina. And when I got there, I met a professor who took some interest in me. And he didn't much care for the church, but he did care about the university. And he started to tell me how I should be a professor as well. How cool it was to travel around the world giving lectures. How fun it was to walk into people's homes and offices and see your book on their bookshelf. How good it felt to be a part of a prestigious university. And for someone like me, whose besetting sin was and is a kind of egotistical drive that leads relentlessly to my own greatness, man, that scratched something deep in the back of my mind. And I decided that I needed to be a professor. And so I applied for a bunch of programs and I got into a good one in my third year and I got ready to accept, but every time I went to accept my offer of admission, I couldn't bring myself to click accept. I couldn't do it, and I didn't know why. And so I started having these long conversations with mentors, long conversations with my wife, Elizabeth, long conversations with God. And as I was having these conversations, my mind kept going back to something that I was doing every Sunday night. Every Sunday night, I would drive from Duke all the way down to South Raleigh, where I worked at a small little church there and was the youth pastor for about 15 students. And of all the things that I did, I got the least accolades for this job, least number of well dones, least amount of prestige. And yet of all the things I did on a weekly basis, that was my favorite thing that I did. And so I began to think about this decision that I faced. I realized that God was probably actually calling me to go into the church. Not that it's wrong to be a professor, but for me, my path was going to be the church. And so I remember sitting down with my professor and telling him my decision. And he called me stupid. He did, seriously, he did. He called me stupid. He said that I was making a stupid decision. Said that I was leaving a lot of wealth and prestige and security on the table to go work for a church. And our relationship kind of ended that day because he couldn't understand why I would make a decision that to him and to the rest of the world kind of looked down into the left when I had an opportunity to do something that was up and to the right. But what he couldn't understand was that for me, it didn't feel like a decision that was that way. Because that was the way of the cross. And for me, the cross was the way of salvation. Jesus had died for me on the cross. And so whatever it was that Jesus wanted me to do, I had to go do it. I had to follow the way of the cross, even if it looked foolish to the rest of the world. So here's the thing. What is Paul not saying? He's not saying then that you have to make your decisions based on which is going to make you suffer more or hurt more. That's not what he's saying. Lord knows that we need good Christian CEOs. We need good Christian lawyers. We need good Christian doctors. In God's great plan, you may have a life that to the rest of the world does look up and to the right. But even if that's what your life looks like vocationally, you are going to have opportunities to follow the way of the cross. God is going to call you in different moments and seasons of your life to take a step down into the left and follow him, even if it looks foolish to the rest of the world. I think about my mom and my aunt, who for the last 10 years have so faithfully cared for their aging and dying parents, my grandparents, both of whom have now gone to be with Jesus. And you know, it really cost them something. It cost them a lot of time. It cost them a lot of energy. It cost them a lot of effort. It cost them a lot of resources. But if you talked to them and if you asked them, they wouldn't do anything differently because they felt like that's what it looked like to follow Jesus. That even if the rest of the world said that they were foolish and they should leave their parents to themselves, they knew that to follow the way of the cross meant that they were going to take care of their aging parents. And so you may be in a similar season where you've got parents who are aging that you now have to take care of, or you're raising a child with a disability and you're looking at a lifetime of caring for them, you are following the way of the cross. You are within the will of God, and God is pleased with you in that. You may be in a marriage that is unhealthy, that is suffering. There's not a lot of happiness there. And the rest of the world may look at you and say, man, there is happiness on the other side of divorce. You can take that happiness and you can run with it. But I'm telling you that the way of the cross probably looks like fighting for that marriage and fighting to recover the happiness of that marriage, even though it looks foolish to the rest of the world. You may be at a vocational crossroads where over here you've got an option to take a job that is up and to the right from a pay perspective, but over here you have a job that actually requires a pay cut but may give you greater opportunity for impact. And for some reason, you feel like God wants you to take that second option. Are you willing to do it? If Jesus calls you to follow the way of the cross and take the option that doesn't make sense to the rest of the world, are you willing to do that? Paul's going to press this point further in 1 Corinthians 4. You should go read it after this, where he's going to lay out his own life for the Corinthians. And in laying out his own life and his own suffering and the lack of prestige that he's had, he's going to ask them, what if God never wants you to become wealthy? What if you never become particularly influential? What if you never get better? What if you never have kids? What if you never have much of an impact on the world? What if you die and within two generations, people have forgotten your name? But in all of that, you were following Jesus and you were following the way of the cross. Would you be okay with that outcome? Let me turn the question around on myself. Would I be okay with that outcome? Probably not. Some days I think I would be. But most days I still like to think about my life as one that is going to look like it's up and to the right to the rest of the world. But what I want is to be able to break that habit. And what I want is to be able to say that I would be okay with it, because I know that when I follow the way of the cross, I'm following the will of God. And within the will of God, there's more joy and more peace and more true happiness than following any other way of the world or any other definition of success. I want to get there. And I know also that by breaking this habit and following the way of the cross, I'm setting myself up to be able to break this second habit that Paul's going to talk about, which is believing that life is just all about my way or the highway. This is what he says in verse 22. He says, "For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." So just like with the first habit that Paul is talking about, Paul starts the second habit talking about two separate groups of people. He talks about the Jews and about the Greeks. And each of them are coming into the church and are displaying preferences in different ways. The Jews are coming in and they're looking for experience. They're taking notes on the band. They're taking notes on the lights. They want to have an emotional experience in church. They want to see miracles. They want to see God moving. And if they don't have that, they're out of here. Not the church for them. The Greeks, on the other hand, are coming in and they're skipping worship. Who needs that emotional stuff? And they're sitting in the back and they're just taking notes on the sermon because they just want the information. They want to know how to be right, how to answer those who would question them, how to know more, how to be the most interesting person at any party or any gathering that they would go in. So they come in after worship, they stay for the sermon, and then after the sermon's over, they leave. They don't need to stay for any kind of response song. They've gotten the information. And look, Paul has issues with both of these problems in themselves, but the bigger issue that he has with what the Jews and the Greeks are doing is that they are smuggling in a habit of the world into the church, a kind of selfishness that leads them to think that everything that they do and everything that they experience, including church, should be about them, about their preferences, and about their ways. That life is their way or the highway, and if anybody gets in their way, they've got to push them to the side. This is how it was in the ancient world. There's no ethic in the ancient world of taking care of the weak, of loving your neighbor, of watching over those who are less fortunate than you. No, in the ancient world, might makes right. You assert your will, your way, your preferences, and if anybody gets in the way, you push them to the side. And again, just like in the ancient world, this is ingrained in our culture too. We don't have time to go into all of the statistics about how Americans think about themselves, how much they think about themselves, how they exercise their will in the world. But we don't have to, because we could just read the lyrics from one of the most famous songs of all time, the most requested funeral song in the UK, and one of the most requested funeral songs of all time in the United States, My Way by Frank Sinatra. At the end of that song, in the last verse, Frank Sinatra sings, "For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not. To say the things he truly feels and not the words of one who kneels." This is a terrible song. But we all sing along to it. He's saying he's not submitting his will to anyone. If anything comes against him, he's not kneeling. He's insisting on his own way because he did life and he did it his way. And we laugh at that. But there's a reason that we belt it out along with everybody else at funerals when it's played, or retirement parties, or when it comes on the radio, or it's on a karaoke, because there's something deep inside of us that likes the idea that life is about my way, my preferences, my will, what I want. And if anybody gets in my way, I'm going to push them out of the way. To that, Paul says, no. You can't follow the cross and hold to that habit. They're incompatible. The cross to those who hold this habit is going to look foolish. It's going to look like a stumbling block. It's going to look like a scandal. Because by its very nature, the cross represents someone who is so submitted to the will of God and so concerned with the eternal destinies of those around him that he submitted himself to that humiliating, tortuous death on a cross. And so Paul's saying, if you want to follow the way of the cross, you've got to lay down your way. You've got to lay down your preferences. You've got to lay down your desires. A good marriage will teach you this kind of naturally. I got married in July of 2020. And right after that, a month later, Elizabeth and I drove across the country to North Carolina, where I was going to start seminary and she was going to start grad school. And I remember my very first seminary class was with someone that I had admired since I was in middle school. I'd been reading him forever. And when I got there to class, he had us all stand up and go around and introduce ourselves. Came to me, I stood up and said, "Hi, I'm Michael. I got married last month." And he interrupted me. He didn't let me finish. And he said, "Oh, so you're discovering just how much of a selfish son of a blank you really are." Except he didn't say blank. And it was like, "Hey man, we're in a seminary. We've all got Bibles in front of us. Also, I've kind of looked up to you forever and your first words to me are curse words. And also, you know what? Yeah, I am learning that. That is something that I'm learning." Just that week, Elizabeth and I had had our first big fight of our marriage, and it had to do with something that had happened on our wedding day on July 10th. I woke up on the morning of July 10th, the proud owner of exactly one pillow. And you know what I did with that pillow? I slept on it. Because that's what pillows are for. But by the end of the day of July 10th, 2020, I was the owner of 25 different pillows. And they don't just all go on the bed. I don't know if you know this. Like, pillows also go on the couch. They go on chairs. They go in the dining room for like a pop of color or something. And woe be me if I ever accidentally sit down on one of these pillows. And so I came in that week from a run and I was tired. It had been hot. I sat down and I accidentally sat down on one of these pillows. And Elizabeth said, please don't sit down on the pillow. And I stood up and I took that pillow and I slammed it down on the floor. And I said, you don't ever want me to be comfortable. And then she stood up and she said, and you don't care about all the work that I've put into making this a beautiful place. And we both stomped off to our own separate corners of the apartment, which weren't that far apart. It was a very small apartment. And I was sitting there and I was stewing. And I was thinking, you know what? I think I am right. Pillows are made for sleeping. But then I got thinking, do I really want my marriage to die over some pillows? And I thought, probably not. And so I surrendered in that fight, and we still own a whole bunch of pillows, and they just keep multiplying. I kid you not, I already had planned out to tell this story yesterday. Elizabeth didn't know it. She went to a store yesterday and gave me a call asking if we could get some more pillows. Because our bedroom, it needs a pop of color. And I said, yes, yes, babe, we can do that. Because I'm learning that to have a healthy marriage and to be a healthy believer in my marriage, to display the cross to my wife, I've had to learn to die to my preferences. And so this is true for all sorts of areas of our lives. Are you willing to lay down your preferences, even your right to be right, in order to display the cross to those around you? Next week, we're going to talk about interpersonal conflict. If you're fighting with someone, are you willing to surrender, even if you're right, in order to demonstrate the way of the cross to them? If you're in an office, Paul's going to say, do everything for the glory of God in 1 Corinthians 12. If you're in an office and you have a boss who doesn't understand you, who doesn't get you, who doesn't care to understand you, are you going to keep showing up every day doing your work as unto the Lord in order to display the cross to your boss? When it comes to things like food and drink, Paul's going to say that we as Christians have a right to eat or drink almost anything we want in moderation, including alcohol. But he's going to challenge us. If you have somebody in your life who needs to quit drinking, a friend or a family member, and they're asking you to quit too so that you can help them stop, are you going to lay down your right and are you going to demonstrate the way of the cross to them by helping them out? Or are you just going to assume that Friday night means that I'm going to have a shiner and your way needs to go to the side? If we want to follow the way of the cross, we're going to have to learn to break ourselves of the habit of insisting on our own way and laying it down as we follow Jesus. And so two things as we wrap up here, one a practice and the other a promise. Here's the practice. You saw in the plugs earlier that we had our ministry expo last week. And you got to see all of the amazing things that we have going on here at FaithBridge. This is the practice for us this morning. How is it that we break ourselves of the habits that Paul's talking about here? How is it that we break ourselves of the habit of believing and assuming that life is all up and to the right? Well, it's going to be by taking a step down into the left and realizing that there is power in the cross even there as we serve other people. And so you may need to get on a serve team this morning. You can find out more information about serve teams and the ministry guides around your chairs at the QR code on the screen. We would love to get you plugged into a place where you can serve other people and practice breaking that habit. What's the first and quickest thing that we can do in order to break ourselves of the habit of believing that life is about my way or the highway? Well, it's by surrounding ourselves with other people, all of whom have different opinions, different preferences, maybe even different political views, and realizing that even when I'm around them, even though I have to submit my way and my preferences to them sometimes, my life really is better when I'm in community. And my life really is better when they're around me. You may need to get plugged into community. Again, in the ministry guide, you can see that. You can scan the QR code. We have grow groups that meet in homes. We have men's ministries, women's ministry. We have a 55 and up ministry, singles, young adults. There is a place for you to get involved and to get into community so that you can begin to break yourself of the habit of believing that life is just about your way or the highway. That's the practice. Now here's the promise. Paul's gonna tell us the promise in verse 26 as he turns the table on the Corinthians. He says, "For consider your calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, and what is weak in the world to shame the strong, and what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God." Here's the promise. There is power for you and the world as you follow the way of the cross. This is what he's telling the Corinthians when he tells them to consider their own calling. When he tells them to consider the fact that not many of them were wise or strong or of noble birth, he is speaking historically. We know that the first people to join the Christian movement were usually not the elites, but were rather those who were low and despised in the world, servants, orphans, widows, women. And as people joined this movement from those ranks all around the empire, Christianity began to grow and the Roman Empire clamped down on it brutally. But these people continued to march their way towards the cross. They walked to their own torture, to their own deaths, to their own humiliation. But they did it with a joy and a hope and even a little bit of a peace and a happiness in a way that demonstrated to the rest of the world that these people have a purpose and a meaning and a power that we don't have because they're willing to go to their deaths and we don't have something like that. This is what I think Ross Douthat, who's a Christian columnist at the New York Times, now at 60 Minutes, this is what I think he was getting at when he interviewed Brian Johnson just last week. He said, "Somebody once said, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And I feel like there's a big part of human existence on this planet that is not devoted to optimizing power, wealth, and money, but is devoted to sacrifice for others. And historically, the central part of that sacrifice has been a willingness to not always die, but to take risks of death so that others might live." And then he asks Brian Johnson a question. He says, "What are you willing to die for, Brian?" And it's so interesting. You should go back and watch or listen to it. Brian Johnson can't answer. He totally avoids the question. He talks about AI. He talks about his health metrics. He talks about why he's not going to die. But he's not able to answer the question, "What are you willing to die for?" And when I heard that, I thought, how sad is it that he really believes that he's going to achieve immortality by himself? And how ironic is it that in trying to free himself from death, he has made himself a prisoner to the fear of death? And Paul looks at an optimizer like Brian Johnson and others like him, and he looks to the Corinthian church and to other Christians, and he says that Christians are the ones who have the power in that contrast. Because there is a power in being willing to die for something rather than live for nothing. There is a power in being willing to embrace suffering for righteousness' sake rather than embrace comfort for apathy's sake. And so there are many of you here in this room who you don't need to be coached on how to live a life that's down and to the left, do you? You know how it feels. For about as long as you can remember, your life has felt like one lack of success after another. Paul has a promise for you, that there is power for you in the way that you continue to walk after the cross. Because as you walk towards the cross in the midst of suffering and questions and disappointment, as you walk towards that cross with a joy and with a hope and with a peace that the world doesn't even have in the best circumstances, you display power to the rest of the world, a power that will make other people want to join. And you are able to do that because you're not just walking to the cross by itself, but you're walking to what comes on the other side. Jesus did not stay dead. Jesus rose again. And when you walk towards that cross, you're not just walking towards death, you are walking towards resurrection, which is just tomorrow. It's around the corner. It's just on the other side. And so you continue to walk with joy and with peace and with hope. And as you do so, know that God has given you a power to bring other people from the rest of the world in, so that we as a healthy church can model what it looks like to be a healthy church, to be healthy spiritually, to a world that wouldn't know better. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your kindness, for your mercy. Thank you for who you are and for your word. Thank you, Lord, for the way of the cross and for the fact that it ultimately leads to resurrection because of what you have done for us. And so Jesus, where there are those of us in here who have fallen into the habit of believing that life is up and to the right, or who have fallen into the habit of believing that life is their way or the highway, God, would you break us of that and give us the ability and the courage to follow the way of the cross so that other people can see the hope and the joy and the peace that we have even in the midst of walking towards you and taking steps down, and know that there is power here that doesn't exist elsewhere. So Lord, be with us, help us, keep our eyes fixed on you, and in all things may you be glorified. It's in your holy and most precious name that we pray. Amen.